I think that's the basis of the circular economy. So if you want to do it really properly, you shouldn't sell the product, you should sell the user experience or the benefit, you know? And normally we shouldn't sell showers, but the shower experience. And we only can sell it if we can take it back.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.
Hello again, and welcome to a Circular Design Summit series. We have three episodes in cooperation with the German Design Council. Why? Circular economy starts with design. And the Circular Design Summit brings together leading experts from industry and design, united by the vision of design as a major driver for circularity in business. After the keynote by Katie Morgenroth, we'll continue with the expert panel. It is moderated by Karel J. Golter, founder and managing director of Indeed Innovation. Panel members are Katie Morgenroth, Head of Sustainable Design at Google, Steffen Ehrath, Head of Innovation and Sustainability at Hans Grohe, and Markus Kühlert, Co-Head Research Unit Production and Consumption Systems at Wuppertal Institute. Before we start, I have an offer for you. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, sign up for the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. But let's hand over to Karel and start with the panel.
Now, the topic in terms of circular shift is all focusing on design. And what we're going to discuss in the next 20, 30 minutes is about the focus on how design can either shift, help shifting the circular economy, and also the other way around. And before we start, I want to make one thing clear. You, dear audience, are a big part of this activation here, right? So we need you by taking part using Slido, asking questions, and to exercise that, we'll have a first poll. So please, now you're allowed to pick up your mobile phones, smartphones, and please follow the link and answer the poll. And hopefully we're going to see the results displayed here on stage as well. And the poll is very simple. I would like to know, for a starter, from all of you, which design discipline do you think will be most impacted by the transition to a circular economy? Okay, so which design discipline do you think will be impacted? So not the other way around, which one will impact circular design, but which one will be impacted by this shift? And I'm very curious to see. And by the way, this is a good start. So keep on using Slido, at least with half of your brain, so that you can still listen to the panelists here, but so we can get a little bit more input from your side. And if it is possible, no, we have to turn our heads if you want to see it. It's interesting. Ooh. So on top is obviously the winning horse, which is industrial and product design. So Peter Post is downstairs giving his masterclass. He would be very interested in seeing that UX is last in terms of which one is going to get impacted. I find that highly interesting, honestly, and maybe that's a good start then to kick the conversation off. So thank you for participating, and please, if you feel like you want to ask a question, drop it. You can vote on it, and then we, or I here with the iPad, can see which one is ranking best, and I will try to mend it and blend it into our conversation. But let's start on our side, guys. So first of all, thank you again for participating. Thank you for giving us actually quite a good segue into the conversation here. And I would love to start with you, Steffen, asking, you know, you described it for you guys in the bath industries and wellness, also personal wellness industry, you could say, that it has different meanings. participating in a circular economy. You just ended about the systemic approach of saying, hey, actually, we have to think about the glue, about the bonding of the different materials in order to facilitate take-back opportunities. So could you tell me maybe how is your industry uniquely approaching circular design, and where do you see the biggest changes happening? Not the challenges, but the changes. Changes for good, maybe, in your entire industry. So that is actually for all of you. Don't only think about your company. We might not be allowed to know about what Google is thinking, but maybe your industry as such. And the same goes for you in a second. So, Stefan, please.
For us, the biggest driver, it's actually architecture, because it's, we call it the GP, the global project business. So they have really set their targets. If you look into Hilton hotels or Motel One or whatever, they have some sustainability targets which are separate from the financial targets. And even some cases, water reduction doesn't make a sense financially. They have this goal and they have it in their MBOs. And this is why for us, the biggest driver for change is actually the residential building and architecture. And I think architects as well as designers, they are very open for this sustainable change. I see a lot of business leaders who are more skeptical because they don't see the business case.
Great, great answer. We'll get back to the business case in a minute. Katie, what about Google or the consumer electronics industry as such, IT and things like that, Google TV, TV industry?
The biggest changes that I've seen internally, sort of helping us move towards a circular economy. I think, I mentioned this a little bit in my talk at the beginning, but I think there is a lot of interplay between software longevity and then sort of the downstream opportunities that come from hardware longevity. And so I do see a lot of focus being put in that area. I will also say, you know, I think a lot of folks have talked about collaboration. I have seen a much more collaborative environment at Google where you do see a lot more problem solving, people from different disciplines coming together to kind of rethink how to work together, given some of the changes we need to make are shifting paradigms quite a bit.
Let me second that. Do you guys ever talk with Apple guys on terms of sustainability and how on a systems level you could collaborate?
We do talk with adjacent industries. Yeah, we do talk with, we talk to people who might be perceived as competitors. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yep, and have invited them to workshops, and we ask for their feedback, we give them ours. I think we actually had a film that we launched at the end, at around Earth Day of last year, called Collaboration for Collective Progress. And the whole philosophy is that, like, this is not a space to compete, but one to work together. And I think it's very refreshing when you do see, you know, two companies that might be perceived as competitors, you know, holding hands and trying to collectively figure out how to move the industry forward. I think our plastic-free packaging is, the guide that we've published is a great example of that.
Absolutely.
This pre-competitive sort of spirit.
Cool, yes, and you're indeed leading that school of thought, I could almost say. Marcus, coming to the Wuppertal Institute, it's not a private company in terms of making profits in that respect, but you probably look very deeply into the cultural aspect of the transition to a circular economy. What would you say to the question about how, you know, the industry is advancing and how circular design is impacted?
Yes, so I believe that also for the science system, there needs to be a change. So we talk about the change in industry, we talked about the change in society, but science has a key role, and therefore we should not talk about different disciplines that have the major role, but we need an interdisciplinary approach, research approach, and we argue also a transdisciplinary research approach, so that we also see practical partners, companies, households as experts of their own system, because we are not deep diving into the strategy of Google or the process, inside process or Hans Groh. So we need also those expertise in our research, and also how can we further develop our methods, and also of course collaborate regarding data. When we look at the data in the electronic sector, there's, in my point of view, quite a black box, so there should be more transparency on the data along the scopes, so that would be great also. So I think also the science system needs to be changed more in with regard to transdisciplinary approach.
And that's an interesting cue I want to take and briefly look to the audience. Who of you is working in education? So like university professor, how many? Raise hands. Yes, a few we have here, right? And I think this is pivotal because in the last 20, 30 years, we have been seeing a lot of separation in discipline. Whereas in former times, you only could do like graphic design and industrial design. Now industrial design is segmented in, I don't know, 10, 20, you know, different sub-disciplines and things like that. So that is happening throughout all industries, not only design, if you think in engineering and probably architecture and things like that, right? And now you're kind of saying we somehow have to bring them all together, right? This is part of your point, and science has to support that. And I would like to take on that and deep dive again in each of your respective industries, starting again, Stefan, if it's okay, with Hans Grohe on the product and industrial design part. Because let's pinpoint it, or try to pinpoint it, and you alluded in your speak before a little bit on it, about longevity. So talking about longevity and the contrast of what you ended with, because everyone thinks about the 20 years of investment when you redesign your bath or build your bath first, and then you say like, well, but what if we could have red tiles and that would be so easy that we could change them after 2 years if you don't like them, right? How do you see that in context of industrial design? How is that fading in? Is it fitting in at all? What needs to happen that we can empower these changes economics?
Yeah. I think that's the basis of the circular economy. So if you want to do it really properly, you shouldn't sell the product. You should sell the user experience or the benefit, you know? And normally we shouldn't sell showers, but the shower experience. And we only can sell it if we can take it back. You know, I cannot sell you a shower, and then if you don't pay the monthly rent, I take it back. So we have to get, you know, a little bit away from producing and selling, because then my margin is the difference between production cost and the price. If I could extend the customer lifetime value and I can circle the product several times, I would design it totally differently. So maybe my design team would maybe use a different material, maybe metals, because it's easier to take back instead of plastics. So this is the issue, but this only makes sense if you think it till the end. And it starts in the mine in Chile, and it ends in the bathroom at home. And we have to design ecosystems that you can take it back. And maybe it's not our job, maybe it's the secondary industry taking care of it.
By the way, dear panelists, if you feel like you want to second an opinion or contrast it, please go ahead. Stefan, I would like to. Stefan, I would like to ask, and did you guys at Hans Grohe change your ID process?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was the way we tried it. It's not the only way. We're not only designing planet-centered. You know, this is like, there is desirability, feasibility, viability. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it comes from R&D, sometimes it comes from the user research, sometimes it comes from business, from markets. We just added the fourth bubble and said maybe sustainability is a starting point as well. And it's not only black or white.
It's so funny to hear you say this, because we literally have that exact diagram on like many slides. And I'm always like, does sustainability go there too? It like ends in a Y, it fits, you know? Yeah. Totally agree. I will also say that selling an experience or an elongating a product's life cycle in order to just enable an experience is very much the reason why we invest a lot in longevity too. Because you can imagine if you're investing in longer lasting hardware, you can hand that product down. You can, you know, resell it, you know, so through a refurbished product business case. And so it is very top of mind for us too.
And thank you for picking that up, Katie. I was wondering during your talk this morning, you alluded a little bit about the longevity and upgradability of the software, basically, so that you can use it. And we all know it that, especially the former Microsoft products, you know, eventually they run out of support, and then you had to basically ditch your computer. Nonetheless, how well, and let's be industry specific rather than Google maybe specific, how well do you think physical design and digital design collaborate together to make sure that circularity is upheld? What would you say?
I think it's emerging. I think we're getting better at it. I think, you know, when you sort of realize that one impacts the other, it's creating more of a circular interaction model within our company. And I think that there's, I think, you know, the thermostat is a proof point of a product that's had a software experience that has gone right alongside the hardware experience to help people reduce their energy consumption at home. I think that's been a really great example for a long time of hardware and software working together. I think we're starting to see, you know, more of this interaction expand into broader parts of the portfolio. Phones is one that's, you know, very central right now, but I think this is gonna, I think the more this gets comfortable, then you can take on the next hard thing and the hard thing after that. And so I think it's step by step, but I think we're making progress.
And by the way, I would like to congratulate both of you because you built a little bit in both of your speeches on that, because the Nest story, you know, although I in the audience there were some like, this is greenwashing kind of a thing. It isn't, because it solved the true problem, right? Because thermostats in the United States were just a thing no one ever touched, right? And it was never right. The temperature was never right, right? And suddenly you solved the problem by not making an additional work stream out of it. You just solved it by a beautiful piece of technology, you could almost say. And that's what you said before, right? Damn, just what is the purpose of your business, and what is the problem you really need to solve? And sometimes that can create beauty.
It is. And if you start with sustainability, sometimes it's not a selling point. We had this discussion earlier. There is a nice work from Johanna Gollenhofer, and she wrote this book about the 60% potential. So there is only 20% of the people, even here in Germany, who really buy green. The 60%, there's 20% they never buy green, but the 60%, if you ask them, they pretend to be green, but in their buying behavior, they're really egocentric. So when you go to market your product, I think you should always put the user benefit first, and then the sustainability benefit is secondary. But it's in a way, thank me later, because it has a benefit the long term. But I wouldn't put this at the first page, because then you stay in the niche, and we have to get into the mass market. So there is really this need to really solve a user benefit as well. Only solving planetary issues is not enough, unfortunately.
Marcus, please.
Maybe with this regard, I also believe that it's very important to think about what we call the literacy. So do you have the, as a consumer, do you have the competencies to distinguish between a sustainable or non-sustainable product, but also getting the possibility to buy a sustainable product? For instance, sustainable nutrition during the day, is there nearby, very easy to get, or is it very, very complex or to receive? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key challenge, or also the opportunity for companies to make those product service systems happen that invites you for also for sufficiency, lifestyle. So how many products, electronic products, also in the bathroom, how many different goods do you really need, or what's the effect of, okay, I get the inspiration of this puristic design, for instance, for a very sufficient lifestyle. And I think this culture that changed through business models, maybe new business models, product as a service business model or service economy, I think that's a challenge, but also opportunity that hasn't been enough discussed and developed so far.
Yeah, to build on that a little bit, I think, you know, in your presentation, you were talking about how a shower head that was made many years ago is not as efficient from a water consumption perspective. And so buying a new one seems counterintuitive to sustainability, but is better. Mm-hmm. And I think in the case of the thermostat, you know, like you say, Carl, it was once a time when they would just run all day long. And so the amount, while it's a very, you know, old and maybe well-made piece of hardware, the result was that there was just a lot of energy drain happening when nobody was even home. And I think you're right that consumer awareness of how their behavior is making an impact is really important. I think something that I know I value is when I get my little report every month as to like how much energy did I save by making more eco-conscious actions at home with my thermostat and my devices. And I think maybe there's an opportunity to extend more of that so that it's lightweight and it's also encouraging, so that it doesn't make people feel like, you know, it's a lecture, but it's like more in their hands.
Yeah. Yes, that's also what you mentioned before about sufficiency, because it's almost with negative and narrative. But I think there's a lot of positive about sufficiency, because you see we have much more diverse solutions or what you can buy or what you haven't buy, you don't need to buy. And there's always opportunity, but not always just a negative impact. Okay, I can't buy this because of mm-hmm. the environmental pressure. So there needs to be a more enjoyable fun in finding the best solution for yourself and also for new business models.
We have a beautiful questions or many beautiful questions from the audience. I'd like to hone in exactly on that one, because the question is also in your communication, Stefan, before about the cool concept you showed. Here the question is, how much of visible, sustainable, or circular look or experience do we need in the future to sell the idea to our customers? Because that's exactly do we even communicate it? You know, and how do we communicate it? Where is the value of the point if it is about the experience? And do I want to experience that I just used a liter of water for my shower instead of 10? Do I actually care?
Yeah. I would say we are living in a distrust society. And how should I trust that this is correct, this information with which stands on the packaging? I think this is now the new reason to strengthen the brand. So I trust brands, and if I trust Hans Grohe, you know, I'm in the relevant set and people buy this brand. So I think the brand is getting more and more important in terms of sustainability, because the single feature, it's so difficult from an end consumer perspective. If you just renovate your bathroom every 20 years, how should I know that the water is now the biggest lever? Maybe I think it's the plastics. So, but if I trust the brand, then I believe them. And this is why I think for marketeers, it's so important to be transparent as well, to show setbacks in the journey of the green transformation, not only tell the nice stories as well, the setbacks, and then try to be authentic. I think that's the best way forward. And yeah.
Marcus, do you have any examples from your research that would underline or?
Yes, so what we argue is that to differentiate on the market with the brand itself, it's not only about the end product and the functionality of the product, but what's about the value chain of the product. And how can you differentiate, for instance, beer in Germany? There's a lot of different brands in beers, and they... Okay, I'm not a very, I can't taste all the difference, but maybe they're quite similar. So to differentiate beer, for instance, in a market, it's not about only the brand, but differentiate what's the value chain behind it, and is it more sustainable, or what's the story behind the value chain of the product? And I think that's what's also one of the differentiation factor that needs to be considered in brand development.
Katie, do you see that mirrored in your strategies? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think marketing, the more authentic we can be with our marketing, the more we will move away from the greenwashing and just being very specific about what are we actually proud of on this product that's moving the needle forward. I do think there's a lot of the use of the word "it depends," because the complexity in this space is massive. You might make a product more durable, but that could have a negative impact on from a carbon perspective. But then you want to incite people to keep using the product. And then how does software play a role? And I think, you know, so we have to continue to sort of pass the baton and continue to build on what we learn. I think from a marketing perspective, you know, even like showing some of the film or static images of our reliability lab, we don't need to just say we made the product more durable. We can show you how, and we can show you what it looks like in those labs. And I think the more we sort of take an authentic approach to sort of amplifying where in the value chain we're working on making an impact, I think it'll be more believable.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, when you look on products, we are always used to have new products which look stunning, always without any issues. If you look into the Japanese culture, you have this wabi-sabi style, you know, the perfection of imperfection. Mm-hmm. And I think this could help us as well in the circular economy to say, for example, we have a wooden floor and now we have some three kids and they play around, and then later you don't argue that there is an issue in your tiles or in your floor. It tells a story. It's like we tell a story when you look at our hair and our skin and everything. It makes it more interestingly. And I think we need this for products as well. And if the chair is 30 years old, maybe it's worth more than when it's new. And this is the mindset we have to change a little bit as well from a consumer perspective, to value maybe the old stuff because it's unique. It's mm-hmm. there is, you know, all the rest we designed here, it's Bauhaus style, so it was designed to manufacture in mass production. This was the need of the time back in the time, but maybe now it's different and we want all hyper personalized products. Maybe this means that they have some issues and some
Let's problems. Use one of the audience questions to ground that a little bit, and we have about 4 minutes left, so let's discuss it. And before we go to a closing question I have for all of you, we have an audience question that has been promoted. The idea of ESPR, so the Eco-Design for Sustainable Products Regulation, is to enable consumers to make more sustainable decisions. How do you prepare for such a legislation, and how do you, you know, go beyond being compliant? And some of you, you know, you went into a little bit, but so first of all, the reality of, you know, the regulations that we face, wandering and changing from times to times, but how would you say, how can we manage, or how are you managing this? And especially then also with the desire of going beyond to be a trailblazer, basically, on that side. Maybe starting with you, Katie.
I can say that, you know, handful of years ago, I didn't know who my compliance partner is, you know, or was. And I can say now, like, we have very regular meetings with one another and we run into each other and we always have something to say. And they're invited into our design, you know, workshops. They're briefing our design team. They're part of, like, you know, that benchmarking process, and they're helping us, like, stay ahead and anticipate the future. So I think they are integral. I think that's a big change. Oh,
is it formalized in your case at Google, the process of how you collaborate? Or is it more driven?
I mean, without being too specific, No, they're a very integral part of the process. Good. Yes, okay. Yes, very awesome. Integral. Yeah.
You know, I take my three kids again. I have three boys and I want them to play football. And if I want them to play football, I don't give them the FIFA rules to read through. This is like sustainability. I go on a soccer field and we score some goals.
Totally.
But it's important that there is a referee, because if they play against others and they play with the hands, they don't have a chance. So I think some people need to read this stuff through, but the innovation department, they should just have fun, and design department, they should see it as a playing ground, a soccer field. If you let them read the CSRD through, they lose the ambition.
Marcus. Would you agree on that?
Yes, in terms of the CSRD, of course, there's a big challenge. And there's also this omnibus development right now, so we will see how it goes. But there's also a point of trust in the EU with this regard. So we also follow the development of regulation very much. And we see, first, it was very specific, very strong, very broad, very complex, and resource intense. And now they change to, okay, completely the opposite. So what's the middle, so that you have impact with regard to regulation? Regulation is it's an instrument to develop new business models and products. And what we see, for instance, the eco-design regulation, that's also driven by products in product categories, but it doesn't meant to be for services. So what's the service behind the product? And I think this point of or this concept needs also to be integrated in the development of regulation, so that it's enhanced the service behind it.
Mm-hmm. Marcus, with my closing question, we start with you, and looking at, you probably all have read one of the Circular Gap reports published by Circular Economy. Weirdly enough, they don't publish that anymore, maybe because it was so delusional, but if we look at the status of circularity globally, it's unfortunately not growing, let's put it that way. But what do you guys, and starting with you, Marcus, think would be the one action, one action designers can take today from your point of view to actually make this shift, this transformation happen, or accelerate, or grow, feed?
Yes, I believe collaboration with the focus on metals, because metals are not the part of discussion today also, maybe partly.
Metals or minerals?
Metals and minerals, yes. And I think there's one of the key drivers when we look at the accessibility of for technical developments, innovation, we need to put a focus on this sector.
Okay, listen well.
Katie. We talk a lot about metals. I can tell you that. Recycled aluminum is a very big topic in our world. You know, I think actually we need to expand the definition of designer. I think that's actually one of the most important things that we can do, because you mentioned being on the field with your, you know, three boys. I think being on the field in the design space, kind of leading by example, getting out ahead, kind of showing how things are done, you're going to need to have like people in a myriad of different areas want to sort of jump in and sort of tackle one little, you know, project or another. And the type of expertise you need to blend isn't the traditional expertise all the time of the design team that maybe you're most familiar with. And so I think we really need to become orchestrators of the work, but really empower the people that are closest to us to like really kind of, okay, designers are people that kind of rethink something and kind of create a new system or a new experience, and help empower people to see how they can do that, and then give them the space to like spread their wings.
Yeah. I would say use your superpower very wisely. You guys are magicians. So designers, they can create irrelevant stuff and make it awesome. So use your power and make the relevant stuff awesome and the irrelevant not so nice. So maybe this is the way how you can guide it through.
Now here we got the innovation revel over there. Dear panel, thank you so much. It has been super inspirational. Thank you, audience, for participating in asking some questions. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. And I would say a big applause for the three here.
This was the expert panel, The Circular Shift, with Karel J. Golter, Katie Morgenroth, Steffen Ehrath, and Markus Kühlert. This episode is part of a series about the Circular Design Summit 2025. If you want to get the actual one-pager about this conversation, please sign up for the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. In the next episode, we will talk about the idea behind the Circular Design Summit. Until then, let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination. My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.